Chapter 15. The personal, as everyone's so fucking fond of saying, is political. So if some idiot politician, some power player, tries to execute policies that harm you or those you care about, take it personally. Get angry. The machinery of justice will not serve you here. It is slow and cold, and it is theirs, hardware and soft. Only the little people suffer at the hands of justice. The creatures of power slide out from under with a wink and a grin. If you want justice, you will have to claw it from them. Make it personal. Do as much damage as you can. Get your message across. That way, you stand a far better chance of being taken seriously next time, of being considered dangerous. And make no mistake about this. Being taken seriously, being considered dangerous, marks the difference, the only difference in their eyes, between players and little people. Players they will make deals with. Little people they liquidate. And time and again they cream your liquidation, your displacement, your torture and brutal execution with the ultimate insult that it's just business, it's politics, it's the way of the world, it's a tough life, and that it's nothing personal. Well, fuck them. Make it personal. Quell Christ Falconer. Things I Should Have Learned By Now. Volume 2. There was a cold blue dawn over the city by the time I got back to Licktown, and everything had the wet gunmetal sheen of recent rain. I stood in the shadow of the expressway pillars and watched the gutted street for any hint of movement. There was a feeling I needed, but it wasn't easy to come by in the cold light of the rising day. My head was buzzing with rapid data assimilation, and Jimmy DeSoto floated around in the back of my mind like a restless demon familiar.
Where are you going, Tac?
To do some damage. The Hendricks hadn't been able to give me anything on the clinic I'd been taken to. From Deke's promise to the Mongol to bring a disc of my torture right back across, I supposed that the place had to be on the other side of the bay, probably in Oakland. But that in itself wasn't much help, even for an AI. The whole Bay Area appeared to be suffused with illegal biotech activity. I was going to have to retrace my steps the hard way. Jerry's closed quarters. Here, the Hendricks had been more helpful. After a brief skirmish with some low-grade counter-intrusion systems, it laid out the Biocabin Club's entrails for me on the screen in my room. Floor plan, security staffing, timetables, and shifts. I slammed through it in seconds, fueled by the latent rage from my interrogation. With the sky beginning to pale in the window behind me, I fitted the Nemex and the Phillips gun in their holsters, strapped on the Tebbit knife, and went out to do some interrogating of my own. I'd seen no sign of my tail when I let myself into the hotel, and he didn't seem to be around when I left either. Lucky for him, I guess. Jerry's Closed Quarters by Don Light. What little cheap erotic mystique had clung to the place by night was gone now. The neon and holosigns were bleached out, pinned on the building like a garish brooch on an old gown. I looked bleakly at the dancing girl, still trapped in the cocktail glass, and thought of Louise, alias an enemy, tortured to a death her religion would not let her come back from. Make it personal. The Nemex was in my right hand like a decision taken. As I walked toward the club, I worked the slide action on it, and the metallic snap was loud in the quiet morning air. A slow, cold fury was beginning to fill me up now. The door robot stirred as I approached, and its arms came up in a warding-off gesture.
"We're closed, friend,"
the synth voice said. I leveled the Nemex at the lintel and shot out the robot's brain dome. The casing might have stopped smaller caliber shells, but the Nemex slugs smashed the unit to pieces. Sparks fireworked abruptly, and the synth voice shrieked. The concertina octopus arms thrashed spastically, then went slack. Smoke curled from the shattered lintel housing. Cautiously, I prodded one dangling tentacle aside with an Nemex, stepped through, and met Milo coming upstairs to find out what the noise was about. His eyes widened as he saw me.
You, what?
I shot him through the throat, watched him flap and tumble down the steps, and then, as he struggled to get back on his feet, shot him again in the face. As I went down the stairs after Milo, a second heavy appeared in the dimly lit space below me, took one shocked look at Milo's corpse, and went for a clumsy-looking blaster at his belt. I nailed him twice through the chest before his fingers touched the weapon. At the bottom of the stairs, I paused, unholstered the Phillips gun left-handed, and stood in silence for a moment, letting the echoes of the gunfire die away in my ears. The heavy artillery rhythm that I'd come to expect of Jerry's was still playing, but the Nemex had a loud voice. On my left was the pulsing red glow of the corridor that led to the cabins. On the right, a spiderweb hollow with a variety of pipes and bottles trapped in it, and the word bar illuminumed onto black, flat doors beyond. The data in my head set a minimal security presence for the cabins, 3 at most, more likely down to 2 at this time of the morning. Milo and the nameless heavy on the stairs down, leaving one more possible. The bar was soundproofed, wired into a separate sound system, and running between 2 and 4 armed guards who doubled as bar staff. Jerry the Cheapskate. I listened, cranking up the Nurichem. From the corridor that led left, I heard one of the cabin doors open stealthily, and then the soft scrape of someone sliding their feet along the ground, in the mistaken belief that it would make less noise than walking. Keeping my eyes fixed on the bar doors to my right, I stuck the Phillips gun around the corner to the left, and without bothering to look, sowed a silent scribble of bullets across the red-lit air in the corridor. The weapon seemed to sigh them out like branches blowing in a breeze. There was a strangled grunt, and then a thud and clatter of a body and weapon hitting the floor. The doors to the bar remained closed. I eased my head around the angle of the wall, and in the stripes of red thrown by the rotating lights, saw a stocky-looking woman in combat fatigues, clutching at her side with one arm, and clawing after a fallen handgun with the other. I stepped quickly across to the weapon and kicked it well out of her reach, then knelt beside her. I must have scored multiple hits. There was blood on her legs, and her shirt was drenched in it. I laid the muzzle of the Phillips gun against her forehead. "You work security for Jerry?" She nodded, eyes flaring white around her irises. "One chance. Where is he?"
"Bar,"
she hissed through her teeth, fighting back the pain.
"Table. Back corner."
I nodded, stood up, and sighted carefully between her eyes.
"Wait, you..."
The Phillips gun sighed. Damage. I was in the midst of the spiderweb hollow, reaching for the bar doors when they swung open, and I found myself face to face with Deke. He had even less time to react to the phantom before him than Milo had. I tipped him the tiniest of formal bows, barely an inclination of my head, and then let go of the fury inside me and shot him repeatedly at waist height with both Nemex and Phillips gun. He staggered back through the doors under the multiple impacts, and I followed him in, still firing. It was a wide space, dimly lit by angled spots in the subdued orange guide lights of the dancer's runway, now abandoned. Along one wall, cool blue light shone up from behind the bar, as if it was fronting an obscure downward staircase to paradise. Behind was racked with the pipes, jack-ins, and bottles on offer. The keeper of this angel's hoard took one look at Deke, reeling backwards with his hands sunk in his ruined guts, and went for the holdout below the bar at a speed that was truly semi-divine. I heard the dropped glass shatter, threw out the Nemex, and hammered him back against the displayed wares on the wall like an impromptu crucifixion. He hung there a moment, curiously elegant, then turned and clawed down a racket of bottles and pipes on his way to the floor. Deke went down too, still moving, and a dim, bulky-looking form leaning against the edge of the runway leapt forward, clearing a handgun from the waist. I left the Nemex focused on the bar, no time to turn and aim, and snapped off a shot from the Phillips gun, half-raised. The figure grunted and staggered, losing his weapon and slumping against the runway. My left arm raised, straightened, and the headshot punched him back onto the dance platform. The Nemex echoes were still dying in the corners of the room. By now I had sight of Jerry. He was 10 meters away, surging to his feet behind a flimsy table when I leveled the Nemex. He froze. "Wise man." The Nurikem was singing like wires, and there was an adrenaline grin hanging crazily off my face. My mind rattled through the count. 1 shell left in the Phillips gun, 6 in the Nemex. "Leave your hands right there, and sit the rest of you down. You twitch a finger, and I'll take it off at the wrist." He sank back into his seat, face working. Peripheral scan told me there was no one else moving in the room. I stepped carefully over Deke, who had rolled into a fetal ball around the damage in his gut and was giving out a deep, agonized wailing. Keeping the Nemex focused on the table in front of Jerry's groin, I dropped my other arm until the Phillips gun was pointing straight down and pulled the trigger. The noise from Deke stopped. At this, Jerry erupted.
"Are you fucking crazy, Riker? Stop it! You can't!"
I jerked the Nemex barrel at him, and either that or something in my face shut him up. Nothing stirred behind the curtains at the end of the runway. Nothing behind the bar. The doors stayed closed. Crossing the remaining distance to Jerry's table, I kicked one of the chairs around backwards and then straddled it, facing him. "You, Jerry," I said evenly, "need to listen to people occasionally. I've told you, my name is not Riker."
"Whoever the fuck you are, I'm connected!"
There was so much venom on the face before me, it was a wonder Jerry didn't choke on it.
"I'm jacked into the fucking machine, you get me? This, all this, you're gonna fucking pay. You're gonna wish..."
"I'd never met you," I finished for him. I stowed the empty Phillips gun back in its fiber grip holster. "Jerry, I already wish I'd never met you. Your sophisticated friends were sophisticated enough for that. But I noticed they didn't tell you I was back on the street. Not so tight with Ray these days, is that it?" I was watching his face, and the name didn't register. Either he was very cool under fire, or he genuinely wasn't fishing in the senior fleet. I tried again. "Trep's dead," I said casually. His eyes moved, just a fraction. "Trep and a few others. Want to know why you're still alive?" His mouth tightened, but he said nothing. I leaned over the table and pushed the barrel of the Nemex up against his left eye. "I asked you a question."
"Fuck you!"
I nodded and settled back onto my seat. "Hard man, huh? So I'll tell you. I need some answers, Jerry. You can start by telling me what happened to Elizabeth Elliot. That should be easy. I figure you carved her up yourself. Then I want to know who Elias Riker is, who Trep works for, and where the clinic is that you sent me to."
"Fuck you!"
"You don't think I'm serious? Or are you just hoping the cops are going to show up and save your stack?" I fished the commandeered blaster out of my pocket, left-handed, and drew a careful bead on the dead security guard on the runway. The range was short, and the beam torched his head off in a single explosion. The stench of charred flesh rolled across the room to us. Keeping one eye on Jerry, I played the beam around a little until I was sure I destroyed everything from the shoulders up, then snapped the weapon off and lowered it. Jerry stared at me over the table.
"You piece of shit! He only works security for me!"
"That's just become a proscribed profession as far as I'm concerned. Deke and the rest are going the same way, and so are you, unless you tell me what I want to know." I lifted the beam weapon. "One chance."
"All right."
The crack was audible in his voice.
"All right, all right. Elliot tried to put a lock on a customer. She got some big-name meth come slumming down here. Reckon she'd got enough shit to twist him. Stupid cunt tried to make me a partnership deal. She figured I could lean on this meth guy. No fucking clue what she was dealing with."
"No." I looked stonily at him across the table. "I guess not." He caught the look,
Hey, man, I know what you're thinking, but it ain't like that. I tried to warn her off, so she went direct to a fucking meth. You think I wanted this place ripped down and me buried under it? I had to deal with her, man, had to.
You iced her? He shook his head.
I made a call,
he said in a subdued voice.
That's how it works around here.
Who's Riker?
Riker's a...
He swallowed.
A cop. Used to work sleeve theft, then they upped him to the organic damage division. He was fucking that Shia cunt. The one came out here the night you crocked Octai.
Ortega?
Yeah, Ortega. Everybody knew it. They say that's how he got the transfer. That's why we figured you were... He was back on the street. When Deke saw you talking to Ortega, we figured she'd accessed someone. Done a deal.
Back on the street? Back from where?
Riker was dirty, man.
Now the flow had started. It was coming in full flood.
He RD'd a couple of sleeve dealers up in Seattle.
RD?
Yeah, RD'd.
Jerry looked momentarily nonplussed, as if I just queried the color of the sky. I'm not from here, I said patiently.
R.D., real death. He pulped them, man. Couple of other guys went down stack intact, so Riker paid off some dipper to register the lot of them Catholic. Either the input didn't take or someone at Orgdam found out. He got the double barrel. 200 years, no remission. Word is, Ortega headed up the squad that took him down.
Well, well. I waved the Nemex encouragingly.
That's it, man. All I got. It's off the wire. Street talk. Look, Riker never shook this place down, even back when he worked ST. I run a clean house. I never even met the guy.
And Octai? Jerry nodded vigorously.
That's it. Octai. Octai used to run spare part deals out of Oakland. Riker used to shake him down all the time. Beat him half to death a couple of years back.
So Octai comes running to you?
That's it. He's like... Crazy, saying Riker must be working some scam down here. So we run the cabin tapes, get you talking to...
Jerry dried up as he saw where we were heading. I gestured again with the gun.
That's fucking it!
There was an edge of desperation in his voice. All right. I sat back a little and patted my pockets for cigarettes. Remembered I had none. You smoke?
Smoke? Do I look like a fucking idiot?
I sighed. Never mind. What about Trep? She looked a little upmarket for your cred. Who'd you borrow her from?
Trep's an indie. Contract hire for whoever. She does me favors sometimes.
Not anymore. You ever see her real sleeve?
No. Wire says she keeps it on ice in New York most of the time.
That far from here?
About an hour, suborbital.
By my reckoning, that put her in the same league as Cadman. Global muscle. Maybe interplanetary, too. The senior fleet. So who's the YRC she's working for now?
I don't know.
I studied the barrel of the blaster as if it were a Martian relic. Yeah, you do. I looked up and offered him a bleak smile. Trep's gone. Unstacked, the works. You don't need to worry about selling her out. You need to worry about me. He stared defiantly at me for a couple of moments, then looked down.
I heard she was doing stuff for the houses.
Good. Now tell me about the clinic. Your sophisticated friends. The envoy training should have been keeping my voice even, but maybe I was getting rusty, because Jerry heard something there. He moistened his lips.
Listen, those are dangerous people. You got away, you better just leave it at that. You got no idea what they...
I've got a pretty good idea, actually. I pointed the blaster into his face. The clinic.
Christ, they're just people I know. You know, business associates. They can use the spare parts sometimes, and I...
He changed tack abruptly as he saw my face.
They do stuff for me sometimes. It's just business.
I thought of Louise, alias an enemy, and the journey we'd taken together. I felt a muscle beneath my eye twitch, and it was all I could do not to pull the trigger there and then. I dug up my voice instead and used it. It sounded more like a machine than the door robot had. We're going for a ride, Jerry. Just you and me, to visit your business associates. And don't fuck with me. I've already figured out it's over the other side of the bay, and I've got a good memory for places. You steer me wrong, and I'll RD you on the spot. Got it? From his face, I judged that he did. But just to make sure, on the way out of the club, I stopped beside each corpse and burned its head off down to the shoulders. The burning left an acrid stench that followed us out of the gloom and into the early morning street like a ghost of rage. There's a village up on the north arm of the Millsport Archipelago where, if a fisherman survives drowning, he's required to swim out to a low reef about half a kilometer from shore, spit into the ocean beyond, and return. Sarah's from there, and once, holed up in a cheap swamp hotel, hiding from heat both physical and figurative, she tried to explain the rationale. It always sounded like macho bullshit to me. Now, marching down the sterile white corridors of the clinic once again, with the muzzle of my own Phillips gun screwed into my neck, I began to have some understanding of the strength it must take to wade back into that water. I'd had cold shivers since we went down in the elevator for the second time, Jerry holding the gun on me from behind. After Inanen, I'd more or less forgotten what it was like to be genuinely afraid, but virtualities were a notable exception. There, you had no control, and literally anything could happen. Again and again. They were rattled at the clinic. The news of Trep's barbecue ride must have reached them by now, and the face that Jerry had spoken to on the screen at the discreetly appointed front door had gone death white at the sight of me.
"We thought..." "Never mind that," Jerry snapped. "Open the fucking door. We've got to get this piece of shit off the street."
The clinic was part of an old turn-of-the-millennium block that someone had renovated in neo-industrial style, doors painted with heavy black and yellow chevrons, facades draped in scaffolding, and balconies hung with fake cabling and hoists. The door before us divided along the upward points of the chevrons and slid noiselessly apart. With a last glance at the early morning street, Jerry thrust me inside. The entrance hall was also neo-ind, more scaffolding along the walls and patches of exposed brickwork. A pair of security guards were waiting at the end. One of them put out a hand as we approached, and Jerry swung on him, snarling.
"I don't need any fucking help. You're the wipeouts who let this motherfucker go in the first place."
The two guards exchanged a glance, and the extended grasp turned into a placatory gesture. They conveyed us to an elevator door that proved to be the same commercial-capacity shaft I'd ridden down from the parking lot on the roof last time. When we came out at the bottom, the same medical team was waiting, sedating implements poised. They looked edgy, tired, butt end of the night shift. When the same nurse moved to hypo me, Jerry brought out the snarl again. He had it down to perfection.
"Never fucking mind that!"
He screwed the Phillips gun harder into my neck.
"He isn't going anywhere. I want to see Miller."
"He's in surgery."
"Surgery?"
Jerry barked a laugh.
"You mean he's watching the machine make pick and mix? All right, Chung then."
The team hesitated.
"What? Don't tell me you got all your consultants working for a living this morning."
"No, it's..." The man nearest me gestured. "It's not procedure, taking him in awake."
"Don't fucking tell me about procedure!"
Jerry did a good impression of a man about to explode with fury.
"Was it procedure to let this piece of shit get out and wreck my place after I sent him over here? Was that fucking procedure? Was it?"
There was silence. I looked at the blaster, Nemex, shoved into Jerry's waistband, and measured the angles. Jerry took a renewed grip on my collar and ground the gun under my jaw once again. He glared at the medics and spoke with a kind of gritted calm.
"He ain't moving. Got it? There isn't time for this bullshit. We are going to see Chung. Now, move!"
They bought it. Anyone would have. You pile on the pressure and most people fall back on response. They give in to the higher authority, or the man with the gun. These people were tired and scared. We double-timed it down the corridors, past the operating theater I had woken up in, or one like it. I caught a glimpse of figures gathered around the surgery platform, the auto-surgeon moving spider-like above them. We were a dozen paces further along when someone stepped into the corridor behind us.
"Just a moment."
The voice was cultured, almost leisurely, but it brought the medics and Jerry up short. We turned to face a tall, blue-smocked figure wearing blood-stained spray-on surgical gloves and a mask, which he now unpinned with one fastidious thumb and forefinger. The visage beneath was blandly handsome. Blue eyes and a tan complexion, square-jawed face. This year's competent male, courtesy of some upmarket cosmetic salon.
Miller,
Jerry said. What exactly is going on here? Kuralt? The tall man turned to the female medic. You know better than to bring subjects through here unsedated.
Yes, sir. Mr. Sadaka insisted that there was no risk involved. He said he was in a hurry to see Director Chung.
I don't care how much of a hurry he's in.
Miller swung on Jerry, eyes narrowing with suspicion.
Are you insane, Sadaka? What do you think this is, the visitor's gallery? I've got clients in there, recognizable faces. Kuralt, sedate this man immediately.
Oh well, no one's lucky forever. I was already moving. Before Kuralt could lift the hypospray from her hip sack, I yanked both the Nemex and the blaster from Jerry's waistband and spun, firing. Kuralt and her two colleagues went down, multiply injured. Blood spattered on antiseptic white behind them. Miller had time for one outraged yell, and then I shot him in the mouth with the Nemex. Jerry was just backing away from me, the unloaded Phillips gun still dangling from his hand. I threw up the blaster.
Look, I did my fucking best!
The beam cut loose, and his head exploded. In the sudden quiet that followed, I retraced my steps to the doors of the surgery and pushed through them. The little knot of figures, immaculately suited to a man and woman, had left the table on which a young female sleeve was laid out, and were gaping at me behind forgotten surgical masks. Only the autosurgeon continued working unperturbed, making smooth incisions and cauterizing wounds with abrupt little sizzlings. Indistinct lumps of raw red poked out of an array of small metal dishes collected at the subject's head. It looked unnervingly like the start of some arcane banquet. The woman on the table was Louise. There were 5 men and women in the theater, and I killed them all while they stared at me. Then I shot the autosurgeon to pieces with the blaster and raked the beam over the rest of the equipment in the room. Alarms sirened into life from every wall. In the storm of their combined shrieking, I went around and inflicted real death on everyone there. Outside, there were more alarms, and 2 of the medical crew were still alive. Kuralt had succeeded in crawling 12 meters down the corridor in a broad trail of her own blood, and one of her male colleagues, too weak to escape, was trying to prop himself up against the wall. The floor was slippery under him, and he kept sliding back down. I ignored him and went after the woman. She stopped when she heard my footsteps, twisted her head to look around, and then began to crawl again, frantically. I stamped a foot down between her shoulders to make her stop, and then kicked her onto her back. We looked at each other for a long moment while I remembered her impassive face as she had put me under the night before. I lifted the blaster for her to see. "Real death," I said, and pulled the trigger. I walked back to the remaining medic who had seen and was now scrabbling desperately backwards away from me. I crouched down in front of him. The screaming of the alarms rose and fell over our heads like lost souls.
"Jesus Christ,"
he moaned as I pointed the blaster at his face.
"Jesus Christ, I only work here."
"Good enough," I told him. The blaster was almost inaudible against the alarms. Working rapidly, I took care of the 3rd medic in similar fashion, dealt with Miller a little more at length, stripped Jerry's headless corpse of its jacket, and tucked the garment under my arm. Then I scooped up the Phillips gun, tucked it into my waistband, and left. On my way out along the screaming corridors of the clinic, I killed every person I met, and melted their stacks to slag. Personal. The police were landing on the roof as I let myself out of the front door and walked unhurriedly down the street. Under my arm, Miller's severed head was beginning to seep blood through the lining of Jerry's jacket. Part 3 Alliance Application Upgrade Chapter 16 It was quiet and sunny in the gardens at Suntouch House, and the air smelled of mown grass. From the tennis courts came the faint popping of a game in progress, and once I heard Miriam Bancroft's voice raised in excitement. Flash of tanned legs beneath a flaring white skirt and a puff of shell-pink dust where the driven ball buried itself in the back of her opponent's court. There was a polite ripple of applause from the seated figures watching. I made my way down toward the courts, flanked by heavily armed security men with blank faces. The players were taking a game break when I arrived, feet planted wide in front of their seats, heads down. As my feet crunched on the gravel surround, Miriam Bancroft looked up through tangled blonde hair and met my eye. She said nothing, but her hands worked at the handle of her racket, and a smile split her lips. Her opponent, who also glanced up, was a slim young man with something about him that suggested he might genuinely be as young as his body. He looked vaguely familiar. Bancroft was seated at the middle of a row of deck chairs, Amma Prescott on his right arm and a man and woman I'd never met on his left. He didn't get up when I reached him. In fact, he barely looked at me. One hand gestured to the seat next to Prescott.
"Sit down, Kovach. It's the last game."
I twitched a smile, resisting the temptation to kick his teeth down his throat, and folded myself into the deck chair. Amma Prescott leaned across to me and murmured behind her hand.
"Mr. Bancroft has had some unwanted attention from the police today. You are being less subtle than we had hoped."
"Just warming up," I muttered back. By some prior agreed time limit, Miriam Bancroft and her opponent shrugged off their towels and took up position. I settled back and watched the play, eyes mostly on the woman's taut body as it surged and swung within the white cotton, remembering how it looked unclothed, how it had writhed against me. Once, just before a service, she caught me looking at her, and her mouth bent in fractional amusement. She was still waiting for an answer from me, and now she thought she had it. When the match finished, in a flurry of hard-fought but visibly inevitable points, she came off court glowing. She was talking to the man and woman I didn't know when I approached to offer my congratulations. She saw me coming and turned to include me in the little group.
"Mr. Kovach,"
her eyes widened the slightest bit,
"did you enjoy watching?"
"Very much," I said truthfully. "You're quite merciless." She tipped her head to one side and began to towel her sweat-soaked hair with one hand.
"Only when required,"
she said.
"You won't know Nalin or Joseph, of course. Nalin, Joseph, this is Takashi Kovach, the envoy Lorenz hired to look into his murder. Mr. Kovach is from off-world. Mr. Kovach, this is Nalin Ertekin, Chief Justice of the UN Supreme Court, and Joseph Feary, from the Commission of Human Rights."
"Delighted." I made a brief formal bow to both of them. "You're here to discuss Resolution 653, I imagine." The two officials exchanged a glance, then Feary nodded.
"You're very well informed," he said gravely. "I've heard a lot about the envoy corps, but still I'm impressed. How long have you been on Earth, exactly?"
About a week," I exaggerated, hoping to play down the usual paranoia elected officials exhibit around envoys.
"A week, yes, impressive indeed."
Feary was a heavy-set black man, apparently in his 50s, with hair that was graying a little, and careful brown eyes. Like Dennis Nyman, he affected external eyewear, but where Nyman's steely lenses had been designed to enhance the planes of his face, this man wore the glasses to deflect attention. They were heavy-framed and gave him the appearance of a forgetful cleric, but behind the lenses, the eyes missed nothing.
"And you are making progress with your investigation?"
This was Ertekin, a handsome Arab woman a couple of decades younger than Feary, and therefore likely on at least her second sleeve. I smiled at her. "Progress is difficult to define, Your Honor. As Quell would have it, they come to me with progress reports, but all I see is change, and bodies burnt."
"Ah, you are from Holland's world, then?" Kurtikin said politely.
And do you consider yourself a Quellist, Mr. Kovach?
I let the smile become a grin. Sporadically, I'd say she had a point.
Mr. Kovach has been quite busy, in fact,
Miriam Bancroft said hurriedly.
I imagine he and Lorenz have a lot to discuss. Perhaps it might be better if we left them to these matters. Yes, of course,
Ertikin inclined her head.
Perhaps we'll talk again later.
The three of them drifted over to commiserate with Miriam's opponent, who was ruefully stowing his racket and towels in a bag. But for all Miriam's diplomatic steerage, Nalin Ertikin did not seem unduly concerned to make her escape. I felt a momentary glimmer of admiration for her. Telling a UN executive, in effect an officer of the Protectorate, that you're a Quellist is a bit like confessing to ritual slaughter at a vegetarian dinner. It's not really the done thing. I turned to find Amal Prescott at my shoulder.
Shall we?
She said grimly, and pointed up toward the house. Bancroft was already striding ahead. We went after him at what I thought was an excessive pace.
One question, I managed between breathing. Who's the kid, the one Mrs. Bancroft crucified?
Prescott flicked me an impatient glance.
Big secret, huh?
No, Mr. Kovach, it is not a secret, large or otherwise. I merely think you might do better occupying your mind with other matters than the Bancrofts' house guests. If you must know, the other player was Marco Kawahara.
Was it, indeed?
Accidentally, I'd slipped into Fury's speech patterns. Chalk up a double strike for personality. So that's where I've seen his face before. Takes after his mother, doesn't he?
I really wouldn't know,
Prescott said dismissively.
I have never met Ms. Kawahara.
Lucky you.
Bancroft was waiting for us in an exotic conservatory, pinned to the seaward wing of the house. The glass walls were a riot of alien colors and forms, among which I picked out a young mirrorwood tree and numerous stands of martyrweed. Bancroft was standing next to one of the latter, spraying it carefully with a white metallic dust. I don't know much about martyrweed beyond its obvious uses as a security device, so I had no idea what the powder was. Bancroft turned as we came in.
Please keep your voices reasonably low.
His own voice was curiously flat in the sound-absorbent environment.
Martyrweed is highly sensitive at this stage of development. Mr. Kovach, I assume you're familiar with it?
Yeah.
I glanced at the vaguely hand-shaped cups of the leaves, with the central crimson stains that had given the plant its name.
You're sure these are mature?
Fully. On Adoracion, you'll have seen them larger, but I had Nakamura tailor these for indoor use. This is as secure as a Nilvibe cabin, and...
He gestured to a trio of steel-framed chairs beside the martyrweed.
A great deal more comfortable.
You wanted to see me, I said impatiently. What about?
For just a moment, that black iron stare bent on me with the full force of Bancroft's 3½ centuries, and it was like locking gazes with a demon. For that second, the meth soul was looking out, and I saw reflected in those eyes all the myriad ordinary single lives that they had watched die, like the pale flickerings of moths at a flame. It was an experience I'd had only once before, and that was when I'd taken issue with Riley and Kawahara. I could feel the heat on my wings. Then it was gone, and there was only Bancroft, moving to seat himself and setting the powder spray aside on an adjacent table. He looked up and waited to see if I would sit down as well. When I did not, he steepled his fingers and frowned. Amal Prescott hovered between us.
Mr. Kovach, I am aware that by the terms of our contract I agreed to meet all reasonable expenses in this investigation, but when I said that, I did not expect to be paying for a trail of willful organic damage from one side of Bay City to another. I have spent most of this morning buying off both the West Coast Triads and the Bay City Police, neither of whom were very well disposed toward me even before you started this carnage. I wonder if you realize how much it is costing me just to keep you alive and out of storage.
I looked around at the conservatory and shrugged. I imagine you can afford it. Prescott flinched. Bancroft allowed himself the splinter of a smile.
Perhaps, Mr. Kovach, I no longer wish to afford it.
Then pull the fucking plug.
The martyr weed trembled visibly at the sudden change in tone. I didn't care. Abruptly, I was no longer in the mood for playing the Bancrofts' elegant games. I was tired. Discounting the brief period of unconsciousness at the clinic, I'd been awake for over 30 hours, and my nerves were raw from the continual use of the Neurochem system. I'd been in a firefight. I had escaped from a moving air car. I had been subjected to interrogation routines that would have traumatized most human beings for a lifetime. I had committed multiple combat murders. And I had been in the act of crawling into bed when the Hendrix let Bancroft's curt summons through the call block I'd requested. Quote, "In the interests of maintaining good client relations and so assuring continued guest status." Someday, someone was going to have to overhaul the hotel's antique service industry idiolect. I had weighed the idea of doing it myself with a Nemex when I got off the phone, but my irritation at the hotel's enslaved responses to guest holding was overridden by the anger I felt toward Bancroft himself. It was that anger that had stopped me ignoring the call and going to bed anyway, and propelled me out to Sun Touch House dressed in the same rumpled clothes I'd been wearing since the previous day.
"I beg your pardon, Mr. Kovach."
Amal Prescott was staring at me.
"Are you suggesting..."
"No, I'm not, Prescott. I'm threatening." I switched my gaze back to Bancroft. "I didn't ask to join this fucking no-dance. You dragged me here, Bancroft. You pulled me out of the store on Harlan's World, and you jacked me into Elias Riker's sleeve just to piss Ortega off. You sent me out there with a few vague hints and watched me stumble around in the dark, cracking my shins on your past misdemeanors. Well, if you don't want to play anymore, now that the current's running a little hard, that's fine with me. I'm through risking my stack for a piece of shit like you. You can just put me back in the box, and I'll take my chances 117 years from now. Maybe I'll get lucky, and whoever wants you toasted will have wiped you off the face of the planet by then." I'd had to check my weapons at the main gate, but I could feel the dangerous looseness of the envoy combat mode stealing over me as I spoke. If the meth demon came back and got out of hand, I was going to choke the life out of Bancroft there and then just for the satisfaction. Curiously, what I said seemed only to make him thoughtful. He heard me out, inclined his head as if in agreement, then turned to Prescott.
"Ow, can you drop out for a while? There are some things that Mr. Kovach and I need to discuss in private."
Prescott looked dubious.
"Shall I post someone outside?"
she queried, with a hard glance at me. Bancroft shook his head.
"I'm sure that won't be necessary."
Prescott left, still looking dubious, while I struggled not to admire Bancroft's cool. He'd just heard me say I was happy to go back into storage. He'd been reading my body count all morning, and still he thought he had my specs down tight enough to know whether I was dangerous or not. I took a seat. Maybe he was right. "You've got some explaining to do," I said evenly. "You can start with Riker's sleeve and go on from there. Why'd you do it, and why conceal it from me?"
"Conceal it?" Bancroft's eyes arched. "We barely discussed it."
"You told me you'd left the sleeve selection to your lawyers. You were at pains to stress that. But Prescott insists you made the selection yourself. You should have briefed her a bit better on the lies you were going to tell."
"Well,"
Bancroft made a gesture of acceptance,
"a reflexive caution, then. One tells the truth to so few people, in the end it becomes a habit. But I had no idea it would matter to you so much. After your career in the Corps and your time in storage, I mean, do you usually exhibit this much interest in the past history of the sleeves you wear?"
"No, I don't. But ever since I arrived, Ortega's been all over me like anti-contaminant plastic. I thought it was because she had something to hide. Turns out she's just trying to protect her boyfriend's sleeve while he's in the store. Incidentally, did you bother to find out why Riker was on stack?" This time, Bancroft's open-handed motion was dismissive.
"A corruption charge, unjustified organic damage, and attempted falsification of personality detail. I understand it wasn't his first offense."
"Yeah, that's right. In fact, he was well known for it. Well known and very unpopular,
especially around places like Licktown, which is where I've been the last couple of days, following the trail of your dripping dick. But we'll come back to that. I want to know why you did it. Why am I wearing Riker's sleeve?
Bancroft's eyes flared momentarily at the insult, but he was really too good a player to rise to it. Instead, he shot his right cuff in a displacement gesture I recognized from diplomatic basic, and smiled faintly.
Really, I had no idea it would prove inconvenient. I was looking to provide you with suitable armor, and the sleeve carries...
Why Riker? There was a beat of silence. Meths were not people you interrupted lightly, and Bancroft was having a hard time dealing with a lack of respect. I thought about the tree beyond the tennis courts. No doubt Ortega, had she been there, would have cheered.
A move, Mr. Kovach. Merely a move.
A move? Against Ortega?
Just so.
Bancroft settled back into his seat.
Lieutenant Ortega made her prejudices quite clear the moment she stepped into this house. She was unhelpful in the extreme. She lacked respect. It was something that I remembered, an account to be adjusted. When the short list Amal provided me with included Elias Riker's sleeve, and listed Ortega as paying the tank mortgage, I saw the move as almost karmic. It dictated itself.
A little childish for someone your age, don't you think? Bancroft inclined his head.
Perhaps. But then, do you recall a General McIntyre of Envoy Command, resident of Harlan's World, who was found gutted and decapitated in his private jet a year after the Inanen massacre?
Vaguely. I sat, cold, remembering. But if Bancroft could play the control game, so could I.
Vaguely.
Bancroft raised an eyebrow.
I'd have thought a veteran of Inanen could scarcely fail to recall the death of the commander who presided over the whole debacle, the man many claim was actually guilty by negligence for all those real deaths.
McIntyre was exonerated of all blame by the Protectorate Court of Inquiry, I said quietly. Do you have a point to make? Bancroft shrugged.
Only that it seems his death was a revenge killing, despite the verdict handed down by the court. A pointless act, in fact, since it could not bring back those who died. Childishness is a common enough sin amongst humans. Perhaps we should not be so quick to judge.
Perhaps not. I stood up and went to stand at the door of the conservatory, looking out. Well, then don't feel that I'm sitting in judgment. But why exactly didn't you tell me you spent so much time in whorehouses?
Ah, the Elliot girl. Yes, Almao has told me about this. Do you seriously think her father had something to do with my death?
I turned back. Not now, no. I seriously believe he had nothing to do with your death, in fact, but I've wasted a lot of time finding that out. Bancroft met my eye calmly.
I'm sorry if my briefing was inadequate, Mr. Kovach. It is true I spend some of my leisure time in purchased sexual release, both real and virtual. Or, as you so elegantly put it, whorehouses. I'd not considered it especially important. Equally, I spend part of my time in small-scale gambling. And occasionally, null-gravity knife-fighting. All of these things could make me enemies, as indeed could most of my business interests. I didn't feel that your first day in a new sleeve on a new world was the time for a line-by-line explanation of my life. Where would I expect to begin? Instead, I told you the background of the crime and suggested that you talk to Almao. I didn't expect you to take off after the first clue like a heat-seeker. Nor did I expect you to lay waste to everything that got in your way. I was told the Envoy Corps had a reputation for subtlety.
Put like that, he had a point. Virginia Vidora would have been furious. She probably would have been right behind Bancroft, waiting to deck me for gross lack of finesse. But then, neither she nor Bancroft had been looking into Victor Elliot's face the night he told me about his family. I swallowed a sharp retort, and marshaled what I knew, trying to decide how much to let go of.
Lorenz?
Miriam Bancroft was standing just outside the conservatory,
a towel draped around her neck and her racket under one arm.
Miriam.
There was a genuine deference in Bancroft's tone, but little else that I could determine.
I'm taking Nalen and Joseph out to Hudson's Raft for a scuba lunch. Joseph's never done it before, and we've talked him into it.
She glanced from Bancroft to myself and back.
Will you be coming with us?
Maybe later,
Bancroft said.
Where will you be?
Miriam shrugged.
I hadn't really thought about it. Somewhere on the starboard decks. Benton's, maybe?
Fine. I'll catch up with you. Spare me a kingfish if you see one.
Aye, aye.
She touched the blade of one hand to the side of her head in a ludicrous salute that made both of us smile unexpectedly. Miriam's gaze quivered and settled on me.
Do you like seafood, Miss Kovach?
Probably. I've had very little time to exercise my tastes on Earth, Mrs. Bancroft. So far I've eaten only what my hotel has to offer.
Well, once you've developed a taste for it,
she said significantly,
maybe we'll see you as well.
Thank you, but I doubt it.
Well,
she repeated brightly.
Try not to be too much longer, Lorenz. I'll need some help keeping Marco off Nalen's back. He's fuming, by the way.
Bancroft grunted.
The way he played today, I'm not surprised. I thought for a while he was doing it deliberately.
Not the last game, I said, to no one in particular. The Bancrofts focused on me. He unreadably. She with her head tipped to one side and a sudden wide smile that made her look unexpectedly childlike. For a moment I met her gaze, and one hand rose to touch her hair with what seemed like fractional uncertainty.
Curtis will be bringing the limousine around, she said. I'll have to go. It was a pleasure to see you again, Mr. Kovach.
We both watched her stride away across the lawn, her tennis skirt tilting back and forth. Even allowing for Bancroft's apparent indifference to his wife as a sexual being, Miriam's wordplay was staring fractionally too close to the wind for my liking. I had to plug the silence with something.
Tell me something, Bancroft, I said, with my eyes still on the receding figure. No disrespect intended, but why does someone who's married to her, who's chosen to stay married, spend his time in, quote, purchased sexual release?
I turned casually back and found him watching me without expression. He said nothing for several seconds, and when he spoke, his voice was carefully bland.
Have you ever come in a woman's face, Kovach?
Culture shock is something they teach you to lock down very early on in the core. But just occasionally a blast gets through the armor, and the reality around you feels like a jigsaw that won't quite fit together. I barely chopped off my stare before it got started. This man, older than the entire human history of my planet, was asking me this question. It was as if he'd asked me had I ever played with water pistols.
Yes. It happens if...
A woman you paid?
Well, sometimes. Not especially.
I remembered his wife's abandoned laughter as I exploded into and around her mouth, cum trickling down over her knuckles like foam from a popped champagne bottle. I don't really remember. It's not a special fetish of mine, and...
Nor of mine,
the man in front of me snapped, with rather too much emphasis.
I chose it merely as an example. There are things, desires in all of us that are better suppressed, or at least that cannot be expressed in a civilized context.
I'd hardly counterpose civilization with spelling semen.
You come from another place,
Bancroft said broodingly.
A brash, young, colonial culture. You can have no concept of how the centuries of tradition have molded us here on Earth. The young of spirit, the adventurous, all left on the ships in droves. They were encouraged to leave. Those who stayed were the stolid, the obedient, the limited. I watched it happen. And at the time I was glad, because it made carving out an empire so much easier. Now I wonder if it was worth the price we paid. Culture fell in on itself, grappled after norms to live by, settled for the old and familiar. Rigid morality, rigid law, the UN declarations fossilized into global conformity. There was
he gestured,
a sort of supracultural straitjacket, and with an inherent fear of what might be born from the colonies, the protectorate arose while the ships were still in flight. When the first of them made planetfall, their stored peoples woke into a prepared tyranny.
You talk as if you stood outside it. With this much vision, you still can't fight your way free? Bancroft smiled thinly.
Culture is like a smog. To live within it, you must breathe some of it in, and inevitably be contaminated. And in any case, what does free mean in this context? Free to spill semen on my wife's face and breasts? Free to have her masturbate in front of me, to share the use of her flesh with other men and women? 250 years is a long time, Mr. Kovach. Time enough for a very long list of dirty, degrading fantasies to infest the mind and titillate the hormones of each fresh sleeve you wear, while all the time your finer feelings grow purer and more rarefied. Do you have any concept of what happens to emotional bonds over such a period?
I opened my mouth, but he held up his hand for silence, and I let him have it. It's not every day you get to hear the outpourings of a soul centuries old, and Bancroft was in full flow.
No,
he answered his own question.
How could you? Just as your culture is too shallow to appreciate what it is to live on Earth, your life experience cannot possibly encompass what it is to love the same person for 250 years. In the end, if you endure, if you beat the traps of boredom and complacency, in the end what you are left with is not love. It is almost veneration. How then to match that respect, that veneration, with the sordid desires of whatever flesh you are wearing at the time? I tell you, you cannot.
So instead you vent yourself on prostitutes?
The thin smile returned. I am not proud of myself, Mr. Kovach. But you do not live this long without accepting yourself in every facet, however distasteful. The women are there. They satisfy a market need, and are recompensed accordingly. And in this way, I purge myself.
Does your wife know this?
Of course, and has for a very considerable time. Almau informs me that you are already aware of the facts regarding Lila Bagan. Miriam has calmed down a lot since then. I'm sure she has adventures of her own.
How sure? Bancroft made an irritated gesture.
Is this relevant? I don't have my wife monitored, if that's what you mean, but I know her. She has her appetites to contend with, just as I do.
And this doesn't bother you?
Mr. Kovach, I am many things, but I am not a hypocrite. It is the flesh, nothing more. Miriam and I understand this. And now, since this line of questioning doesn't seem to be leading anywhere, can we please get back on track? In the absence of any guilt on the part of Elliot, what else do you have?
I made a decision then that came up from levels of instinct way below conscious thought. I shook my head. There's nothing yet.
But there will be?
Yes. You can write Ortega off to the sleeve, but there's still Cadman. He wasn't after Riker. He knew me. Something's going on. Bancroft nodded in satisfaction.
Are you going to speak to Cadman?
If Ortega lets me.
Meaning?
Meaning the police will have run whatever satellite footage they've got over Oakland this morning, which means they can probably identify me leaving the clinic. There must have been something overhead at the time. I don't suppose they'll be at their most cooperative. Bancroft permitted himself another of his splintered smiles.
Very astute, Mr. Kovach, but you need have nothing to fear on that count. The Y Clinic, what little you left of it, is reluctant to either release internal video footage or press charges against anyone. They have more to fear in any investigation than you do. Of course, whether they choose to seek more private reprisals is, shall we say, a more protracted question.
And Jerry's?
A shrug.
The same. With the proprietor dead, a managing interest has stepped in.
Very tidy.
I'm glad you appreciate it.
Bancroft got to his feet.
As I said, it has been a busy morning, and negotiations are by no means at an end. I would be grateful if you could limit your depredations somewhat in the future. It has been costly.
Getting to my feet, just for a moment, I had the traceries of fire at Inanen across the back of my vision. The screaming deaths heard at a level that was bone deep. And suddenly Bancroft's elegant understatement rang sickly and grotesque, like the antiseptic words of General McIntyre's damage reports, for securing the Inanen beachhead, a price well worth paying. Like Bancroft, McIntyre had been a man of power, and like all men of power, when he talked of prices worth paying, you could be sure of one thing. Someone else was paying. Chapter 17. The Fell Street Station was an unassuming block done out in a style I assumed must be Martian Baroque. Whether it had been planned that way as a police station or taken over after the fact was difficult to decide. The place was potentially a fortress. The mock-eroded ruby-stone facings and hooded buttresses provided a series of natural niches in which were set high, stained-glass windows edged by the unobtrusive nubs of shield generators. Below the windows, the abrasive red surface of the stonework was sculpted into jagged obstructions that caught the morning light and turned it bloody. I couldn't tell whether the steps up to the arched entrance were deliberately uneven or just well-worn. Inside, stained light from a window and a peculiar calm fell on me simultaneously. Subsonics, I guessed, casting a glance around at the human flotsam waiting submissively on the benches. If these were arrested suspects, they had been rendered remarkably unconcerned by something, and I doubted it would be the Zen populist murals that someone had commissioned for the hall. I crossed the patch of colored light cast by the window, picked my way through small knots of people conversing in lowered tones, more appropriate to a library than a holding center, and found myself at a reception counter. A uniformed cop, presumably the desk sergeant, blinked kindly back at me. The subsonics were obviously getting to him as well. "Lieutenant Ortega," I told him. "Organic damage."
"Who shall I say it is?"
"Tell her it's Elias Riker." Out of the corner of my eye, I saw another uniform turn at the sound of the name. But nothing was said. The desk sergeant spoke into his phone, listened, then turned back to me.
"She's sending someone down. Are you armed?"
I nodded and reached under my jacket for the Nemex.
"Please surrender the weapon carefully," he added with a gentle smile. "Our security software is a little touchy, and it's apt to stun you if you look like you're pulling something."
I slowed my movements to frame advance, dumped the Nemex on the desk, and set about unstrapping the Tebbit knife from my arm. When I was finished, the sergeant beamed beatifically at me.
"Thank you. It'll all be returned to you when you leave the building."
The words were barely out of his mouth when two of the Mohicans appeared through a door at the back of the hall and directed themselves rapidly toward me. Their faces were painted with identical glowers that the subsonics apparently made little impact on in the short time it took them to reach me. They went for an arm apiece.
"I wouldn't," I told them. "Hey, he's not under arrest, you know," the desk sergeant said pacifically.
One of the Mohicans jerked a glance at him and snorted in exasperation. The other one just stared at me the whole time, as if he hadn't eaten red meat recently. I met the stare with a gentle smile. Following the meeting with Bancroft, I had gone back to the Hendrix and slept for almost 20 hours. I was rested, neurochemically alert, and feeling a cordial dislike of authority of which Quell herself would have been proud. It must have shown. The Mohicans abandoned their attempts to paw me, and the three of us rode up 4 floors in silence, broken only by the creak of the ancient elevator.
Ortega's office had one of the stained glass windows, or more precisely, the bottom half of one, before it was bisected horizontally by the ceiling. Presumably, the remainder rose missile-like from the floor of the office above. I began to see some evidence for the original building having been converted to its present use. The other walls of the office were environment-formatted, with a tropical sunset over water and islands. The combination of stained glass and sunset meant that the office was filled with a soft orange light in which you could see the drifting of dust motes. The lieutenant was seated behind a heavy wooden desk, as if caged there, chin propped on one cupped hand, one shin and knee pressed hard against the edge of the desk. She was brooding over the scroll-down of an antique laptop when we came through the door. Aside from the machine, the only items on the desktop were a battered-looking heavy-caliber Smith & Wesson and a plastic cup of coffee, heating tabs still unpulled. She dismissed the Mohicans with a nod.
"Sit down, Kovach."
I glanced around, saw a framed chair under the window, and hooked it up to the desk. The late afternoon light in the office was disorienting. "You work the night shift?" Her eyes flared.
"What kind of crack is that?"
"Hey, nothing." I held up my hands and gestured at the low light. "I just thought you might have cycled the walls for it. You know, it's 10 o'clock in the morning outside."
"Oh, that,"
Ortega grunted, and her eyes swiveled back down to the screen display. It was hard to tell in the tropical sunset, but I thought they might be gray-green, like the sea around the maelstrom.
"It's out of sync. The department got it cheap from someplace in El Paso Juarez. Jams up completely sometimes."
"That's tough."
"Yeah, sometimes I'll just turn it off, but the neons are..."
She looked up abruptly.
"What the fuck am I... Kovach, do you know how close you are to a storage rack right now?"
I made a span of my right index finger and thumb and looked at her through it. "About the width of a testimony from the Y Clinic was what I heard."
"We can put you there, Kovach. 7:43 yesterday morning, walking out the front door larger than life."
I shrugged.
"And don't think your meth connections are going to keep you organic forever. There's a Y Clinic limo driver telling interesting stories about hijack and real death. Maybe he'll have something to say about you."
"Impound his vehicle, did you?" I asked casually. "Or did Y reclaim it before you could run tests?" Ortega's mouth compressed into a hard line. I nodded.
"Thought so. And the driver will say precisely zero until Y springs him, I imagine."
"Listen, Kovach. I keep pushing. Something's got to give. It's a matter of time, motherfucker. Strictly that."
"Admirable tenacity," I said. "Shame you didn't have some of that for the Bancroft case."
"There is no fucking Bancroft case!"
Ortega was on her feet, palms hard down on the desktop, eyes slitted in rage and disgust. I waited, nerves sprung in case Bay City police stations were as prone to accidental suspect injury as some others I had known. Finally, the lieutenant drew a deep breath and lowered herself joint by joint back into her seat. The anger had smoothed off her face, but the disgust was still there, caught in the fine lines at the corners of her eyes and the set of her wide mouth. She looked at her nails.
"Do you know what we found at the Y Clinic yesterday?"
"Black market spare parts? Virtual torture programs? Or didn't they let you stay that long?"
"We found 17 bodies with their cortical stacks burnt out. Unarmed. 17 dead people. Really dead."
She looked up at me again, the disgust still there. "You'll have to pardon my lack of reaction," I said coldly. "I saw a lot worse when I was in uniform. In fact, I did a lot worse when I was fighting the Protectorate's battles for them."
"That was war."
"Oh, please." She said nothing. I leaned forward across the desk. "And don't tell me those 17 bodies are what you're on fire about either." I gestured at my own face. "This is your problem. You don't like the idea of someone carving this up." She sat silent for a moment, thinking, then reached into a drawer of the desk and took out a pack of cigarettes. She offered them to me automatically,
and I shook my head with clenched determination. I quit.
Did you?
There was genuine surprise in her voice, as she fed herself a cigarette and lit it.
Good for you. I'm impressed.
Yeah. Riker should be pleased, too, when he gets off stack. She paused behind the veil of smoke, then dropped the pack back into the drawer and palm-heeled it shut.
What do you want?
She asked flatly. The holding racks were 5 floors down in a double-story basement, where it was easier to regulate temperatures. Compared to Psychosec, it was a toilet.
I don't see that this is going to change anything,
Ortega said, as we followed a yawning technician along the steel gantry to slot 3089B.
What's Cadman going to tell you that he hasn't told us?
Look. I stopped and turned to face her, hands spread and held low. On the narrow gantry we were uncomfortably close. Something chemical happened, and the geometries of Ortega's stance seemed suddenly fluid, dangerously tactile. I felt my mouth dry up. She said.
3089B,
the technician called, hefting the big 30-centimeter disc out of its slot.
This the one you wanted, Lieutenant?
Ortega pushed hurriedly past me.
That's it, Mickey. Can you set us up with a virtual?
Sure.
Mickey jerked a thumb at one of the spiral staircases, collared in at intervals along the gantry.
You want to go down to 5, slap on the trodes. Take about 5 minutes.
The point is, I said, as the three of us clattered down the steel steps, you're the Shia. Cadman knows you. He's been dealing with you all his professional life. It's part of what he does. I'm an unknown. If he's never been extra system, the chances are he's never met an envoy before. And they tell nasty stories about the Corps most places I've been. Ortega gave me a skeptical look over her shoulder.
You're going to frighten him into a statement? Dmitri Cadman? I don't think so.
He'll be off balance, and when people are off balance, they give things away. Don't forget, this guy's working for someone who wants me dead. Someone who is scared of me, at least superficially. Some of that may rub off on Cadman.
And this is supposed to convince me that someone murdered Bancroft after all?
Ortega, it doesn't matter whether you believe it or not. We've been through this already. You want Riker's sleeve back in the tank ASAP out of harm's way. The sooner we get to whatever bottom there is to Bancroft's death, the sooner that happens. And I'm a lot less likely to incur substantial organic damage if I'm not stumbling around in the dark. If I have your help, in fact. You don't want the sleeve to get written off in another firefight, do you?
Another firefight?
It had taken nearly half an hour of heated discussion to hammer the sense of the new relationship into Ortega, and the policewoman in her still hadn't gone to sleep on me. Yeah, after the Hendrix. I improvised rapidly, cursing the face-to-face chemical interlock that had put me off balance. I picked up some bad bruising there. Could have been a lot worse. She shot me another, longer glance over her shoulder. The virtual interrogation system was housed in a series of bubble-fab cabins at one side of the basement floor. Mickey settled both of us onto weary-looking auto-mold couches that were slow to respond to our forms, applied the electrodes and hypnophones, then kicked in the power with a concert pianist's sweep of one arm across 2 of the utilitarian consoles. He studied the screens as they blinked on.
Traffic,
he said, and hawked congestion into the back of his throat with disgust.
Commissioners hooked in with some kind of conference environment, and it's soaking up half the system. Gotta wait till someone else gets off.
He glanced back at Ortega.
Hey, that the Mary Lou Hinchley thing?
Yeah.
Ortega looked across to include me in the conversation, maybe as evidence of our new cooperation.
Last year the Coastals fished some kid out of the ocean. Mary Lou Hinchley. Not much left of the body, but they got the stack. Set it to spin, and guess what?
Catholic?
In one. That total absorb stuff works, huh? Yeah, the first entry scan comes up with barred by reasons of conscience decals. Usually the end of the line in a case like that, but L...
She stopped, restarted.
The detective in charge wouldn't let it go. Hinchley was from his neighborhood. He knew her when she was growing up. Not well, but...
She shrugged.
He wouldn't let it go. Very tenacious. Elias Riker?
She nodded.
He pushed the path labs for a month. In the end, they found some evidence the body had been thrown out of an air car. Organic Damage did some background digging and came up with a conversion less than 10 months old, and a hard-line Catholic boyfriend with skills in infotech who might have faked the vow. The girl's family are borderliners, nominally Christian but mostly not Catholic. Quite rich as well, with a vault full of stacked ancestors that they spin out for family births and marriages. The department's been in virtual consultation with a lot of them on and off all this year.
Roll on Resolution 653, huh?
Yeah.
We both went back to looking at the ceiling above the couches. The cabin was bottom-of-the-line bubble fab, blown from a single globe of polyfiber like chicle in a child's mouth. Doors and windows lasered out and reattached with epoxy hinges afterwards. The curved gray ceiling held absolutely nothing of interest.
"Tell me something, Ortega,"
I said after a while.
"That tale you had on me Tuesday afternoon when I went shopping, how come he was so much worse than the others? A blind man could have spotted him."
There was a pause before she spoke. Then, grudgingly,
"All we had. It was a snap thing. We had to get you covered quick after you dumped the clothes."
"The clothes?" I closed my eyes.
"Oh, no, you tagged the suit? That simple?"
"Yep." I threw my mind back to my first meeting with Ortega. The justice facility, the ride out to Suntouch House. The total recall ripped through the footage on Fast Forward. I saw us standing on the sunlit lawn with Miriam Bancroft, Ortega departing.
"Got it," I snapped my fingers. "You hammered me on the shoulder when you left.
I can't believe I'm this stupid."
"Enzyme bond bleeper," Ortega said matter-of-factly. "Not much bigger than a fly's eye. And we figured, with autumn well set in, you wouldn't be going many places without your jacket. Of course, when you offloaded it into that trash bin, we thought you'd tipped us."
"No, nothing so bright."
"That's it,"
Mickey announced suddenly.
"Ladies and gentlemen, hold on to your spinal spiral. We are in the pipe."
It was a rougher ride than I'd expected from a government department installation, but no worse than many jury-rigged virtuals I'd done on the world. First the hypnos, pulsing their sonocodes until the dull gray ceiling grew abruptly fascinating with fishtail swirls of light and meaning drained out of the universe like dirty water from a sink. And then I was elsewhere. It spread out around me, racing away from my viewpoint in all directions, like nothing so much as a huge magnification of one of the spiral steps we'd used to get down from the gantry. Steel gray, stippled every few meters with a nipple-like swelling, receding to infinity. The sky above was a paler shade of the same gray, with shiftings that seemed vaguely to suggest bars and antique locks. Nice psychology, assuming any of the felons interrogated had anything but race memory of what an actual lock looked like.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.